I'm just checking something.
Yeah,
I'm looking how it connects with the previous one. It refers to the word pada and the word dhamma. Where does the word dhamma appear? Let me search backwards. I'm searching for the word dhamma that's mentioned at the beginning of 71.14. Search up, find next. 71.11 is where the word dhamma last occurs. Okay, the long passage from the Padmapurana? Lord Shiva talking? Yeah. We're talking to Padmapurana. Okay, let me keep that on the screen. Oh, Krishna. Okay, and then go back to 71.14. Okay, now he's... Okay. We had read several citations from various Puranas and Narada Pancharatra and something else about the transcendental nature of Vaikuntha, especially that it's eternal and everything there is eternal. Atra pada dhammadi shabdena sthana vachakena surupe tu arunena yadi kaschit katanchit surupam eva vajayati taryan yatra tat prasange pi. Well, let me just read the first clause. Someone may try to construe, to interpret the words pada, dhamma, and so on in this context as expressing swarupa, personal identity, even though they indicate location, pada, and dhamma, these are descriptions of places. Even if pada is foot, it's a place at the bottom of the body, but it also means Tad Vishnu Paramam Padam, the place, supreme place of Vishnu. That's what the word pada means. And that's what the word dhamma usually means. The abode of the Lord. But somebody might try to interpret these words as meaning swarupa. In other words, try to leave out the abode of Vishnu. And we're just, the impersonalist is just trying to take this, these passages as saying that the identity of the Supreme Absolute Truth is Satchidananda. And without admitting that the place where Bhagawan lives is also Satchidananda. Just by reinterpreting the verses, not to refer actually to a place, but just to the Swarupa of Brahman. Okay, Om Tad Vishnu Paramam Padam. The impersonalist might try to interpret that passage in such a way. Now the word pada is close by. We just read it. It was in the verse in the verses from the Mudgala Upakhyana in the Itihasa Samucha that we read yesterday. The word pada. Tad Vishnu, well, I'm sorry. That's just the phrase from the Rig Veda that's quoted all the time. Tad Vishnu Paramam Padam. And almost every one of these passages we've been reading repeats those, echoes those words. But the word Dhamma, I trace it back as the last time we saw the word Dhamma was back in 71.11. And that was the long passage quoted from the Padma Purana where Lord Shiva is describing to Parvati, Vaikuntha. And he calls that, there he uses the word Dhamma. That's the only close by place here in the Sundarbha where the word Dhamma was recently used. Anyway, these words refer to the place of the Lord, where he lives. It doesn't refer just to his Swarupa, but some impersonalists might try to interpret it, these words as just meaning Swarupa. So what do we make, what do we say in response to that? Arudhina. Do I have that? Yeah. They don't, by normal convention, mean personal identity. Arudha. Rudhi and yoga. You may have read about that yet already in grammar class. It's actually from Kavya, from poetics. Yeah, the two kinds of ways that words derive their meaning. Some words, the meaning can be understood from the construction of the word, the derivation. But other words, they have their meaning only conventionally. You can't take the grammatical pieces of it, put them together and figure out what the meaning is for some words. Some words you can. At least you can take the root and the suffixes and figure out what the word is. You know the word sta means to stand. And the suffix ana makes the verb into a noun. And it can be adhikaranam also, location. So sthana means a place where somebody stands, a location. That's a derivational meaning. You can figure it out from the grammar, from the meaning of the root and the meaning of the suffixes. That's yogika artha, meaning that's understandable from the derivation. But other words, some other words have meanings that are just conventional. And that's called rudhi, convention. And there's a rule of interpretation among the grammarians and the theoreticians of poetry. Yogad rudhir baliyasi. Is that right? Or I have it backwards. Yogad rudhir baliyasi. Conventional meaning is stronger than derivational meaning. If you might think of interpreting one word in two different ways, the conventional meaning has priority, overrules the derivational meaning. For example, Shatpada derivationally means six-footed, having 6 feet. But by scientific definition, all insects have 6 feet. A creature that has 8 feet or not 6 feet is not called properly in science, zoology. You don't call that an insect. You call it an arachnid or something else. Although in common speech, we call all the bugs insects. We don't count their feet. But scientists count the feet. If it has 6 feet, it's an insect. Anyway, six-footed creature, Shatpada. But in Sanskrit, the word conventionally means a bee. Not any insect, but only a bee. That's the convention. And convention overrules the derivation. Properly speaking, Shatpada should refer to a bee, not to any insect. Although a poet can play games with the words and play a trick where it's not, you know, a bee, but it's some special form of Vishnu with 6 feet or something. The poet can twist, but the common, the normal, proper use of the word is to understand, to take the conventional meaning, it's overruling the derivational meaning. Here, the word pada does not mean swarupa in the way it's actually used. Convention. Convention means the way that people who are well educated actually use the language. That's how we find, that's the ultimate test of what's the real meaning of a word, or how a word's used, or what's the proper grammar. Proper grammar, who makes up the grammar? Just some grammarian? You know, what's his name? Vatsyayana, who wrote the Mahabhashya commentary on Panini's original grammar. Very elaborate commentary. In the beginning, he makes a note that we don't go to the village of the grammarians and ask them, please make me some words. Like you go to the village where the potters live and ask them to make you some pots. It's not like that. Grammarians don't make up the words. They don't make up the rules of the language. They're just describing how the language is actually used. But who decides? Who is the judge of the proper way you use words? Uneducated people use words in a sloppy way, and they don't follow the same rules that educated people do. So Panini and others define proper usage as, or Rudi, convention, as the usage of shishta, of properly educated people. How they use the language, how they use the meaning of words, and what kind of grammar they apply to the words. That's the convention, the usage of educated people. It doesn't say rishis. You know, where are we going to find the rishis to ask them whether they, you know, conjugate that verb this way or that way? You're going to go up to Swargaloka and find a rishi to ask? That's not practical. So the practical definition is the way that educated people use words. That's proper convention. Go to an educated person and find out, ask them what this word means. Okay, that's Rudi, the usage of educated people. And educated people don't usually use the word, the words pada, dhamma, and so on to mean sarupa. That's not the Rudi. You may try to squeeze out some derivational meaning like that, but it's not the convention. Oh, now someone may still argue. You know, try to argue that pada, dhamma, and so on don't mean place, Vaikuntha, they mean just the identity of the Supreme Absolute Truth. Well, taryanratra te tatvasamge te, tatvasamge, te bikachanti matstanam, yad brahma paramam vidu ityadau sakshadevastana shabda nigadena tannirasaniyam. Okay, in answer to that proposal, this proposition can be refuted by statements elsewhere on the same topic, which speak the word stana, which derivationally also means place, not just conventionally. So you can't use that argument on that word. And the word is used directly in such statements as, they go to my place, matstanam, which is known as the Supreme Brahman. That's a statement from, where's it from? It's GPD 16, unless I don't have the reference for it. I haven't found it. I don't know where it comes from. Okay, anyway, such a statement is there, according to Jiva Goswami. Well, okay. The impersonalists don't give up. They try to present another way of making it mean what they want to mean. They say, yadi tatrapi chakaradi adyaharadi dainyena purvadarshita etihasa samuchayasya param brahmeti yad vidu iti visheshana viruram vakyabhedam evangi karoti. And even if so, even after saying this, if someone proposes a division into separate statements by the weak contrivance of interpolating persons like and, in the statement of, let's see if I got it right, the Itihas Samuchaya. We're going to take one sentence and artificially imagine it's two separate sentences by assuming that there's a word cha implied there. This is in contradiction to the specific description shown above in the Itihasa Samuchaya, in the words which they know as the Supreme Brahman. Uh, I guess we take the statement, they go to my place, which is known as the Supreme Brahman, and you make two separate statements out of it. They go to my place, and sometime after that, they also go to the Supreme Brahman. They stop off at my place on the way to go to the Supreme Brahman. Yes? Is it Pashyati there? Matsnanam. Abhigachanti Matsnanam. Well, it says two different things. Those who know the Supreme Brahman, they. Abhigama also means to understand, not only go. They go to my place. So it could be understood as two separate statements. These persons, they go to my place and they also understand the Supreme Brahman. And you could even take it to mean that in their less mature state, they go to my place while they're still personalists. And then they become more mature and then they realize the Supreme Brahman. So the impersonalists may try to twist it around by taking it as two separate statements. Okay? By inserting the word cha or other words. Adhyahara means interpolation. To read a word in there to fill out the statement. But here we don't need that. It's perfectly sensible the way it is. There's no need to split up a sentence into two sentences if it makes sense as it is. Okay? In Mimamsa, it's a fault to unnecessarily split a statement into two. You assume that a sentence is coherent as one sentence statement, unless the way it doesn't make sense as it is. Then you have to assume that there's two separate sentences there and add something to split them up. But if it makes sense as it is, don't go to all that trouble of splitting it up. We assume a statement is one sentence unless it has to be split up to make sense. Yes?
Does it mean that
Well, no, let's say it like this. What we have here is more like they go to my matstanam, and they realize the Brahma Paramam. Now we're saying the Paramstanam is Brahma Paramam, but the Mayavadis are taking this to mean two different things. They go to my place, and after visiting me, they make more progress, and they eventually realize the Supreme Brahman. They split it up into two separate activities. Going to his place is one thing, which is nice. It's nice to visit Vishnu. But after that, you got to get to business and realize Supreme Brahman.
For example, you take this Swadhama.
Yeah?
Means his own abode, and at the same time, when it's Swad.
You're actually talking about splitting up the samasas into separate words. That's even more radical and harder to prove. All they're doing is taking, because we do have a relative clause here. Yad Brahma Paramam Vidu. We have two verbs, Abhigachanti and Vidu. So we already have two clauses. There's already a potential split into two separate ideas. You don't have to do such a radical thing as breaking words in half. It's just taking two clauses to be two separate sentences. You understand? Yad Brahma Paramam Vidu is sort of a relative clause that's an adjective describing Matsnanam. Matsnanam, my place, which they understand to be the Supreme Brahman.
Okay, I
see. But you split it up into two separate ideas. They go to my place, and because of that, they realize the Supreme Brahman, make it into two separate ideas. It's a subtle split. You could get away with that. But to try to split up a samasa into two separate words, that's even more far-fetched. All right. Okay, I read the Sanskrit for the next sentence. Let me read the English. I already started reading English, but I didn't finish it. And even if the words pada and dhamma mean a place, not a svarupa, even after hearing that, someone may still propose a division into separate statements by the weak contrivance of interpolating words like "and" to split a sentence into two. They go to my abode and they also realize Supreme Brahman. And that's in contradiction to the specific description shown above in the Itihasa Samuchaya, in the words which they know as the Supreme Brahman. It says, you know, that's my place, which they know to be the Supreme Brahman. That's what it actually says. So anyway, go ahead and contradict that. But then you're going to have to find a way to make the word world that's spoken here. Loka is also one of the words in the passage. It's used here and there in these various passages, the word loka, to serve as a support for his theory. You're going to have to figure out how to explain the word world. You know, they're going to the loka, so how is the loka not a place? Okay. We did see the word loka. Let's see where the word loka is. Let's search for it. Loka, search up. Sayati Vishnu Lokam Yat Vai Daha Pralaya Varjitam. That's in the Skanda Purana, back in 71.13. He goes, the Vishnu Bhakta, who's marked with the Shankha and the Chakra, he goes to Vishnu Loka. And where else does Loka show up? Oh, Narada Pancharatra, Brahma and Narada are talking. Lokam Vakunta Namanam Divya Shadguna Samyutam. There's Loka. It's called Vaikuntha. And Aditya Varnam, in the Padma Purana, Shiva talking to Parvati. Aditya Varnam Tamasat Parasta Jyotirutamam Atato Brahmano Lokam Shuddha Sahal Sanatana. The Loka of Brahman is pure and eternal. The word is loka, describing this, whatever this is. Does loka mean just the identity, the sarupa? So you have to explain that. My body is going to be stuck, not really able to make loka mean sarupa. Okay. Tarhi swamate tatra loka shabdak sahayi kartavya. Tatascha pada dhamma stana loka rupanam te sham shabdanam ekatra vastuni prayogat parasparam anyartam duri kurvantas te kamva naboreanti swam artam. And thus, since all these words pada, dhamma, sthana, loka, and also the word rupa are being used to refer to one and the same object. And they are interacting among one another to remove the possibility of other meanings. These words are all mixed up. They're all obviously referring to the same thing. And so that combination, interaction of all these words make it very hard, or actually make it impossible, to squeeze out this other interpretation that we're referring to the impersonal identity of Brahman. We're talking about a place. How then? So how are these not words? So, how can these words not be signifying their own basic meaning, which is some kind of place? As in the words, the following, yata Bhagavan Harir Vishnu Aryam Iti. As in those words, this is the Supreme Lord Hari, Vishnu. So Hari can also mean lion or name of Indra. But in this context, it's obviously referring to Vishnu, the way the word sentence is set up. The combination of the words make it impossible to misinterpret them and get away with them. Ata, hanta, tatrapi, chet, surupa, matra, vachakatam, bhikshate. Tari, sputameva, padma, vaishnavadi, vachanaya, vipaksho, repaniyaha. And if, sad to say, they still beg to insist that only personal identity is being indicated, then let them find a way to remove the obvious contradiction of the statements of the Padma, Vishnu, and other Puranas. Okay. I don't like personal identity because it's impersonal. Swarupa. Let me make a note to myself. You know, we're talking about Swarupa referring to Brahman. That's not personal identity, that's impersonal identity. Okay, anyway.
What word is?
Swarupa?
What word you change now?
Oh, where I translate Swarupa as personal identity. But it's the impersonalist trying to identify this as the what's being described as the Swarupa of Brahman.
Yeah.
So it's not right to use the word personal there. I didn't decide yet, maybe essential identity or something. I'm just making a note that I have to fix it. I have another note to make. The sentence is a little confusing. Okay, anyway, continuing. I have to fix this up a little bit, but. Karma dya prapya twadi pratipadaka vakyani tu visheshato vetra pani rupani sandhyeva vaktavyam. And it must be said that the statements which establish that Vaikuntha cannot be achieved by karma and so on stand especially as the doorkeepers with club in hand. In other words, Vaikuntha can't be achieved by karma and so on. That means karma or jnana. So your impersonal realization of Brahman, which is the result of the jnana process, that won't allow you in Vaikuntha. Those statements that say that you can't get into Vaikuntha by karma or jnana, they're standing at the door as doorkeepers with clubs in their hands, and they won't let you in. Tasmad om namaste ityadi gadyam api saru eva vakya tam. Thus, the prose text beginning om obeisances to you has also been properly explained. Now, where is that om obeisances to you? Om namaste. Can you find it? Okay, let me search it like this. 71.7, let's read it. No?
Yes.
Let me just search for om namaste.
Yes,
71.1, yeah. This is the prose passage. That's what's actually discussed at the beginning of the Anucheta. So that is actually the basic topic statement of the whole Anucheta, is discussing this prose prayer spoken to Krishna, Vishnu, by the demigods. In sixth canto? Where is it?
6923.
Okay. Om Namaste Stu Bhagavan and Paramahamsa Parivrajakai Paramein Atma Yoga Samadhina, and so on. So, we're concluding at the end of the Anuccheda that we've proven our point that our understanding, our interpretation of that passage is correct. In other words, that only by pure devotional service does one enter Vaikuntha. Deva Shri Harim. This text was spoken by the demigods to Shri Hari. Okay, that's the text at the beginning of the Anuccheda that we just read again, or read part of. That's the topic of the whole Anuccheda. We're now at the end of the Anuccheda, and we finish it up by the tag statement that this was spoken by the demigods to Lord Hari. Okay, now some commentary on this. A short passage from the Sarvasambhadani that deals with this Anuccheda. The prose prayer cited here was offered to Lord Vishnu by the assembled demigods, who were frightened by the birth of the mighty demon Vritra from the sacrificial fire of the Asuras. Lord, that's right, it was the demon's fire that Vritrasura was born from?
Yeah,
Tvashta was sacrificing for the demigods. Okay, I'll have to figure. I already have a note. It's not Asuras, it's Suras. It was demigod's fire. Right? Lord Vishnu responded to the demigod's call for help by appearing before them, and then they spoke these words to him when he appeared. And those are the words at the beginning of the Anuccheda. I'm reading in the wrong place. This is the commentary to 71.1. Let me go back down to the bottom. Okay, 71.14 commentary. The words of scripture cited above include several terms which all have the word place as their primary meaning. Different words, but they all refer to some kind of place. Taking all this evidence together, it becomes difficult to misinterpret Vishnupadam to be not the personal home of Vishnu. Om Tad Vishnu, Om Tad Vishnu Paramam Padam. It's hard now to misinterpret because all the Puranas have explained that Om Tad Vishnu Paramam Padam. And if you accept the Puranas' authority, you can't now try to interpret that Om Tad Vishnu Paramam Padam from the Rig Veda impersonally. It becomes difficult to misinterpret Vishnu Padam to be not the personal home of Vishnu, but the impersonal identity of the Supreme, impersonal. But karmis, yogis, and jnanis are denied, not just the karmis, but the yogis and the jnanis also, are denied entrance to, or even understanding of, Vaikuntha. And so the doorkeeper shastras bar them with their guard's club. This impersonal misconception, that's the club. You know, they beat them back by making them misunderstand. The Shastras say something that the impersonalists misunderstand. And that misunderstanding keeps them out of Vaikuntha. It's not literally that someone's going to beat them on the head with a club, but they're going to get ideas put in their head. And the Shastras are going to do that. Put the wrong ideas into the demons' heads so they misunderstand and never get liberation. This is Krishna's yoga maya working to prevent the envious from understanding him.
Liberation or entering Vaikuntha?
Well, I said liberation because entering Vaikuntha is the supreme liberation. You can't even get impersonal liberation by misunderstanding. You have to have correct knowledge to get impersonal liberation. And you have to have devotion to get into Vaikuntha. But if the Shastras pick you out as an envious demon and inspire you to misunderstand them, then you won't even get your impersonal liberation. What to speak of devotion?
Those who are getting liberation, they are obviously misunderstanding.
Right, but this is the process how they got to misunderstand. This is tracing. How? What made them misunderstand? It was the Lord Himself empowering the Shastras to make them misunderstand.
You mentioned that they can't get, because they misunderstood the Shastras, they can't get liberation. But those who are getting liberated, they did not understand Krishna's Supreme Lord, so there is misunderstanding.
Those who are already liberated?
Those who are liberated, the impersonal, those who achieve impersonal liberation, they don't understand Krishna as a personality of Godhead.
Well, if they're disqualified from understanding Him, if they misunderstand Him, they're not really liberated. If they understand Him partially, only impersonally, see, Brahman realization is a kind of partial realization of Krishna. But if on top of that, partial realization, you also have misconceptions about Krishna, that Krishna, the personality, is an ordinary person, he's mortal, he's imperfect, he's not the supreme, those are misconceptions. Then you're disqualified. Your so-called liberation is a fake. An impersonalist who's actually liberated, he doesn't have any misconceptions, he just has incomplete knowledge. And that knowledge can be made complete, because he's not envious. That's the Brahmavadi, who's not envious, he's just not completely informed. Okay, he only has a partial understanding of the Supreme. But the one who's envious, and because of his envy, Yogamaya is filling him with misconceptions. He's barred. He actually is not, he doesn't even receive impersonal liberation. He just pretends to. Imagine what he has.
So that means Mayavadis can never achieve impersonal liberation?
Unless they stop being Mayavadis.
So what is the destination?
Atamste prejabi gachanti asurya namate loka. They go to the deepest regions of darkness. They become trees or pigs. They become low species of life or go to hell.
There are so much
of
austerities, tapasya, study of
shastra. Demoniac austerities. And studying the Vedas and totally misunderstanding it. Studying the Vedas without faith. Faithless study of the Vedas. Is offensive.
Then why do you have to pay obeisances to Maya sannyasis?
That's just a social convention. Prabhupada explained, we offer respect to the dress of a sannyasi. No matter who the person is, we offer respect to the sannyas order itself. We offer respect, we don't trust. We stay away from such a person, but we can offer, there's no harm in offering some respect.
If you don't offer, it's a sin.
Well, you might argue that you can avoid offering respects to Mayavadis. But if your spiritual authority tells you to, if Chaitanya Mahaprabhu wants us to, then we have to do what he wants us to. If he wants us to offer respects to all Mayavadis, to all sannyasis, then we do it. On the request of our superiors. Otherwise, you could argue that what's the need to show respect to a Mayavadi? You could argue that, but we're just following the etiquette established by our predecessors.
The last question.
Yes.
So when we say that Aruya Kucharena Patanti, Aruya Kucharena Patanti Adhagachma,
yes.
Is it only refers to the
Vimukti Vimukta Maninas? Those who imagine that they're liberated, but they're not really liberated. Vimukta Maninas.
But the verse says they are falling down, which means they achieved some place.
Not really, because they're not really liberated. They it's sort of like temporarily, they didn't enter Vaikuntha, but they are hanging out in the spiritual sky temporarily. But it's not really, it's just the atmosphere surrounding Vaikuntha. They don't actually enter Vaikuntha.
When
you say
that
Mayavadis
are going to
hell,
they will get liberation.
Yeah, because they will, padamtyadak, they fall down from that Brahma Jyoti. And then they're going to have to pay for their offenses in various ways.
But how will they achieve liberation if they're going to hell?
They don't.
Huh?
They haven't actually achieved liberation.
They've been there.
Yeah, but they didn't stay. A really quick training, because they took a lot of trouble. they're allowed to, you know, just be temporarily in the Brahma Jyoti. That's allowed to them. Not for all Mayavadis, but for those who followed the whole Mayavadi program strictly and took all the troubles. Okay, here's your Brahma Jyoti. And we'll even give you a chance to change your attitude, you know, become attracted to Krishna. But if they don't become attracted to Krishna seriously, then they fall down. Because their hearts are not really pure. They don't really deserve to be there. It's just, you know, special, you know, kindness that's shown to them. Okay, let them see the Brahma Jyoti. But it's just temporary.
So after that,
they're not actually liberated. Because that very verse says, Vimukta Maninas. They're presuming themselves to be liberated. That means they're not really liberated.
So then how they go to hell then?
Oh, because they've committed offense. I'm not saying that every one of them will, but according to their offenses against Vishnu and against Vaishnavas, they'll have to pay for their offenses, whatever they were. Just like many of the trees in Vrajadham are previous Mayavadis.
One thing I didn't understand when you say that the Mayavadis are offensive, so they go to hell. At the same time, they're telling that they will go to Brahma Jyoti, they will get a glimpse,
no,
and they fall down.
No, not all of them, only a few.
So what is the different category? Who will go to hell or who will go to Brahma Jyoti and fall down?
The qualification to, you know, it says Amriya Kritrena. Because they take all the trouble, they're allowed to temporarily enter the Brahma Jyoti. But they may also, the same person who has that qualification of having taken done all the sadhana, he may also have committed many offenses. He may have an offensive attitude against Vishnu and his devotees.
Okay.
If they do, if they're envious of Vishnu and the Vaishnavas, they'll have to be punished for that. They can go up to the Brahma Jyoti, they'll have to come down and be sent somewhere to be punished.
Okay.
Right, okay, we have here also, in the Sarvasambhadani, Sri Jiva writes this about this Anuchid the following. So this is the Sarvasambhadani comment on this Anuchid, 71. Om Namaste Ityadi, the section beginning with the words Om Namaste. Deva Sri Harim, which is at the very end. The Devas spoke this to Sri Hari. Ityasya Tasya Haritvam. Where it is said that the verse discussed was spoken by the demigods to Sri Hari, that he is actually Lord Hari. How do we know that the person they're talking to is really the Supreme Lord Hari? Grahat prapan. This is the context of Vishnu coming and saving Gajendra from the crocodile. So how do we know that's really the Supreme Lord who came on that bird? And killed the crocodile. Haritvam grahat prapannam ityadau muktafala vyakyanu svitaikadusha skanda vakya swaras vyal labhyate. Whoa, okay. That says here, there's a spelling mistake I have to fix. The mouse is not cooperating. Okay, there. That he is actually Lord Hari can be inferred from the concordance of the sense of the words of the 11th canto, which begin, he saved the surrendered devotee from the crocodile, which is adhered to by the explanation given in the Muktafala, that's Vopadeva, the Mayavadi. He explains it in the Muktafala like this. But wait a minute. This needs to be explained. Anyway, next sentence. Ata eva trapi atayvam idito rajan sadaram tridashaya hari ityatra hari shabdin aivokto saviti. Thus here also in the words, O King, Lord Hari was thus offered sincere prayers by the demigods. In this passage that we quoted at the beginning of the Anuchid, Om Namaste, Bhagavan Namaste. Sukadeva says, O King, Brikshit, Lord Hari was thus offered supreme prayers, sincere prayers by the demigods. So he is referred to by the name Hari, the one that the demigods are praying to. Okay, thing is, Jiva Goswami takes this statement and says the demigods are praying to Hari. Someone may question, but how do you know that that person who saved Gajendra actually was the Supreme Lord Hari? So we're giving argument here. The Shukadev says that at the end. It doesn't say Hari in the prayer, but at the end, after the prayer, Shukadev says, thus they worshipped, the demigods worshipped Hari. This same pastime is similarly described in the 11th canto. And there, in the verse beginning, Grahat Papanam, who also, I don't know, let's look at this verse. I think this passage from Sarvasambhadani needs to be further explained. I need to add something to the commentary. Let's see. This Grahat Parpanam, let's go find that verse and see what it says. 46, 11.4.18. 11.4.18. Okay. 17? 18. Okay. The nine sons of Rishabdev, the Yogendras, are talking to Nimi Maharaj. And one of them here is talking about the different Leela avatars. And this verse says, verse 11.4.18, Gupto pyaye manur ilau shadayash chamatsye kraude hato titija uddara dambasak shmam karne dvito dvir amrito matane swaprishte grahat papannam ibaraja mamunchadartam. Okay, this verse, in his appearance as a fish, the Lord protected Satyavrata Muni. The earth, he protected also the earth and her valuable jewels. He protected them from the waters of annihilation in his incarnation as a fish. As a boar, the Lord killed Hiranyaksha, the son of Diti, while delivering the earth from the universal waters. And as a tortoise, he lifted Mandara mountain on his back so that nectar could be churned from the ocean. The Lord saved the surrendered king of the elephants, Gajendra, who was suffering terrible distress from the grips of a crocodile. So what we need to add to this commentary is not just quote the Sarvasambhadani, but explain this verse, that this verse is describing the major incarnations of Vishnu, that this is the Supreme Lord we're talking about, who saved Gajendra. So I'm going to copy this in. Any quick questions? We're out of time, but one or two questions? Yeah.
Does it mean that you can do a Hari in this prayer to, for example, the lion or the Indra?
Well, we shouldn't, because it's obviously Vishnu being talked about. Yeah, I mean, you got a lion that was also a fish and a tortoise before? No, this is not just a regular lion. This is the person who has all these different incarnations. Right? It's not somebody else, Hari. Hari Chakravarti or somebody. This is the original Hari. Okay, I think we have to stop now. Yes.
Yes.
You take Vishnupadam.
Vishnupadam. So it can mean either the place of Vishnu or Loka, or the person, they might interpret it as the deity of Vishnu.
Yeah, the real truth inside Vishnu. The impersonal within Vishnu. And it doesn't work. Because it's not just pada that's used, there's so many words paraphrasing that, about five, six different words that all mean place, and it's done elaborately and repeatedly in these different Puranic and other passages. Yes?
And also about conditional and derivational meanings. They don't have conditional meanings and conditional
meanings. Derivational meanings.
Yeah, conventional meanings.
Conventional meanings. In general, the standard is what educated people think. And if it's general knowledge, then we go by the most educated people. If the ordinary scholars say this, but the pure Vaishnavas say something this different, then we'll go with the Vaishnavas because they're better educated. If it's technical knowledge in a certain field, then we go with the experts in that field. Then it's jargon or technical term in a particular field of science or art. Then we understand that it's according, it's according to the specific realm of discourse. The grammarians may use one word to mean something, and the theologians may use the same word with a different meaning. We have to understand which context it's in, which field of knowledge. Okay, but in general, if we're not limited to a particular department of knowledge, and we're talking in general terms, then we follow the opinion of the most learned people. In general, even within each field, we go to the experts, not the amateurs. Yes? Okay. All right, we stop now. Thank you. Om Lursa Srila Prabhupada Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jaya.
Thank you.